Hello, and welcome to Profiles. I'm Owen Johnson. Today, we have the opportunity to meet an individual who plays an important part in the world of journalism and journalism education. Brad Hamm has been dean of the Indiana University School of Journalism since 2005. He came to IU from Elon College, where he was associate dean of journalism. His professional experience includes time with the Associated Press and with the Salisbury, North Carolina Post. Brad, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you, Owen. It's good to be here.
What attracted you to journalism?
I always loved it. When I was young, I remember at 5 or 6 trying to write, thinking about it. I started running track, cross-country, road racing year-round. There was a little youth team, and the coach was a sports writer for the local paper, and I think that helped my career a lot. I think a lot of people, you get to where you are because you sort of stumble into things. I always wanted to do it, but to have somebody that close who was in the newspaper business to help really made a difference. And so I worked on the high school newspaper, worked for the local daily, and covered football. Started out covering high school football, traveling around different places, then went to college and based my college decision at that time on one factor was a major opportunity to write full-time for the daily paper, and I spent 4 years writing, covering sports, news, covering ACC basketball, and when I was 10 or 11, that was my dream, and I had achieved it by the time I was 18 or 19 and wondered what was next. So I probably knew all along what I wanted to do. It was just having somebody who could help me make that connection that made the real difference.
Now, that the paper you worked for was at Salisbury, right?
Yes, family-owned afternoon daily paper, about 30,000 circulation. Interesting thing about the family, the Hurley family, they had been in the newspaper business for 100 years, and they would not spare one dime for news coverage. I remember one time, it did not matter what it was. If they thought it was important, they paid for it. Now, salaries, like for all journalists, were pretty low. I could have used some help there. But in terms of covering things, they absolutely poured the money in. And I remember one time, a simple story, 20 miles away, somebody had said they thought a freight car had overturned, and we got calls from the neighbors. I called the train company out of Atlanta. They denied it. Still kept getting calls. Called them again. They denied it. Still kept getting calls. Called them again, and they just were furious, outraged. How dare you call? How dare you question? Don't ever call us again. And you didn't know where to go from there because it's private property. You can't get any access to it. And the managing editor said, well, we'll charter a plane. And we were up 10 minutes later on a plane, took the photos. I rode there with the photographer. Went back, picked up the phone, called Atlanta. The guy was furious from the start, and he said, there was no derailment. And I said, we chartered a plane. And I'm sure he thought, this is a small paper. I said, we have pictures. He just paused and said, oh, you mean that derailment?
You have talked both about sports and about news. What was it that really excited you? Because they're two quite different kinds of journalism.
They are quite different, and to be honest, I thought in my life I wanted to do sports. I covered so many games, and I think that was helpful the first 4 years. I was covering 5-6 basketball games a week. It really was hard for me to balance school and the workload because I was so into that. I still made good grades. I was not making as good grades as my twin brother at the time, but I was pouring everything I had. I would leave college at about 5 o'clock on a Friday, cover games Friday night. We had an afternoon Saturday, which meant we were in at 7 in the morning, worked till noon. The paper came out in the afternoon. But we were morning on Sunday, which meant we immediately started covering at 1 o'clock, covering right all night, finish up at 1, put the paper out then. So I would almost, if I worked on Sunday, get almost a full work week Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And I covered so many games that at some point they wanted help on the news side. And I did a little bit of that, and I liked it, but, oh, and I didn't like it as much as I like sports. I love sports. I wondered, though, how long I would love it. How many games could I watch? How many years could I cover high school basketball on a Friday night? I loved it for a while, but I think even then I thought once I had finished 100 games or 200 games, how many more games did I want to cover? And I got excited about news. And I think covering news actually would make most sports writers better sports writers because the attention to detail on the news side is harder, I think, than it is on the sports side. Anybody can tell you who the leading scorer is. The answers are easy often in sports coverage, but news coverage is hard.
It's interesting, I think, because a lot of people have gotten into journalism through sports. Scotty Reston, the great writer for the New York Times, was one of those. He was traveling secretary for the Cincinnati Reds, of all things.
A lot of our alums, when I talk to them, if they got into newspapers at some point, I think it was an easy way to get into newspapers. And they went with their heart at the time and eventually settled in for the long term. I bet probably half the news people I've met started in sports or in some different direction and wound up on the news side.
What's your news media consumption today? Are you a newspaper reader, an internet surfer? Do you watch TV? Where do you get your news?
All of it. And I don't sleep as much as I should. So I usually, if I'm awake early morning or stay up really late, I'm usually a combination of internet and television at the same time. And I read a lot. I don't read as much long form as I used to. I don't find only when I travel. If I'm on a plane, I'll do that. I'll pick up. It's harder for me to read magazine pieces or books or monographs. But I try to read at least three papers a day. And I'm one of those people who, if I get the paper and I don't get to it that day, I can't throw it away. So they pile up. One reason I don't subscribe to magazines is it would just shut me down. So I buy magazines and I read online. But if I subscribed, I've had to eliminate that habit because I'll have 10 or 12 magazines piled up and it will take me hours to get through. But I cannot throw them away without going through every page.
Do you have any journalistic heroes?
I always loved Ernie Pyle. And it's interesting that I'm in Ernie Pyle Hall because I always loved Ernie Pyle. When I was in graduate school at the University of South Carolina, the morgue, which is the storage collection of all the articles for the old New York World Telegram, what eventually became the World Telegram and Sun, a Scripps Howard paper in New York that died in the early 1960s after the big newspaper strike. The morgue was at the University of South Carolina. And I went over there and worked on a master's thesis there. And at some point, they decided to throw it all away, which is a crime. They called me. I was at AP one night. They called me and said, "We're going to throw it all away. Take whatever you want." So my twin brother, who's a journalist also, and I took a truck to this archive that filled an entire building, stacked probably 8 or 9 drawers high minimum. You had to get these giant stairs system to, you wheeled them over and you would climb up as high as you could get. You would open these drawers. And I got all of Ernie Pyle's columns from there, and I have them at home. They were just from that morgue. But I loved so many writers at that time. And I was addicted from, I think, second or third grade to biographies. So I've always loved reading. And of course, I love history. So I've read a lot of collections from writers. I read, we have in the journalism school, Roy Howard's archives. And Roy Howard was a leader of Scripps Howard for many years. All of his letters there. And I've read hundreds of his letters. It's interesting to me just to see how the journalists thought about stories, how they did them. And I often think it's hard to be a good writer, and I wouldn't claim to be a good writer. There are many people who are far better at writing than I am, but I think it would be hard to be a good writer unless you're a really good reader. You just need to be reading these talented people and just looking at it the same way athletes look at the best athletes or business leaders look at the best business leaders. I think writers look at the best writers and try to figure out the magic of it.
What about today? Are there journalists that you especially respect today?
You know, we're bringing in David Halberstam. We're bringing in Frank DeFord. I think there are a lot of good writers like that. You'd be hard-pressed, I think, at some point to line them up. They're not as famous today. You know, I think about maybe the Walter Winchell era, and no one's claimed he was a great writer, but he was quite a cultural figure. When you think of Westbrook Pegler, and maybe, you know, he went off the deep end, but people clearly remember those. I think of the story about Walter Lippmann being the last sort of central figure. Some people say Howard was the last of the newspaper leaders. If you looked around in America today and asked people who runs a paper, they don't know. They're corporate owned. They might know that the Times is owned by a family, or they might know their local papers. And in some ways, it's like that with the writers. I think if writers appear on television, they're known, but they're not often known as well as they used to be. But if you go back 50 years ago, everybody knew those people, and it was a magical era. I think the writing is just as good in many ways. We're just not quite as aware of the byline, maybe.
Now, is that part of the problem of what people call corporatization of the media, that it is stockholders that own the media? Is that a problem?
It's a problem in a real sense where you demand a certain profit margin. I mean, we could go into the university and say, this university must produce a surplus of $1 billion. I mean, anybody can say that. Many companies in America are quite happy with a lower profit margin. Many of the discount grocery stores, Walmart, those kind, developed a different model. And they looked at the model. I knew a grocery store in the East Coast that they had decided instead of one slow nickel, they wanted five fast pennies. And that was, so they put their prices as low as possible, made 1 cent off of each can of whatever they sold. And they sold them so fast that over the long haul, they made it a whole lot faster. And I think Walmart has followed that in other places. Newspapers have gone in a different direction and did for many years. Once the afternoon papers died off in most major cities, and once the competition died off, they kept plowing along and expected more and more and more. There are papers that do layoffs if they drop below 30% profit margins. 30% profit margins are shocking to any business leader. So when we hear about layoffs at newspapers and people say, well, the industry's really struggling, well, it just depends in a way. If you said, I'll take a 10% profit margin, then maybe you're not laying off, you're hiring people. That part of the expectation of what we see of newspapers, how much money can you make? That period of time for newspapers when they were monopolies in cities with advertisers is long gone. It makes you wonder when the corporate model will change. When is 1 penny or 2 cents or 3 cents enough, rather than saying make a dollar out of every $2? I think that profit margins are just so high that newspapers aren't taking a chance on the great writers. Magazines might, the internet might, other people might, or they simply create their own businesses and they write their own books and they make their own money.
I want to continue this conversation, but let's take a break now and hear some of the music you particularly like. Can you describe this first selection?
Keiko Matsui is a Japanese artist who is living in New York, and I have a fascination with Japan, as you may see in my work. I taught there. I love visiting there. I try to go 2 or 3 times a year. And so I attended an Asian American Journalist Association meeting, and I had heard about Keiko Matsui. And at that meeting, they said, we have seats for everybody to hear Keiko Matsui tonight for free. And I went over a little early and wound up having sort of the front row seat, and I watched her show and It's beautifully done. And on this piece, her husband joins her on a specific Japanese instrument that I think makes for a beautiful sound. Selection from Keiko Matsui is a piece that at the end of the concert, her husband came out and joined her, and she does this nice jazz sound, and she plays, and she's up front, and then her husband comes out, and he brings out an instrument that I have not seen before, but my wife, who's Japanese, recognizes. And I was just stunned by the effect of combining the different pieces. I'm not a musician, but I certainly love the style. And it was one of those moments where you were lucky to be where you were and lucky to be listening to that. And I guess in a way, sometimes people take an instrument that's not well known and they master it and then they put it in. And you sort of see what is different from a commercial world. And I think in a way, if we apply that to journalism, newspapers would be a whole lot better. Television would be a whole lot better if they were risk takers like this, if they had specialization like that.
It's a nice lead in to continue our conversation on journalism. Your experience was in newspapers. You've talked about newspaper heroes, and yet many people would say that newspapers are the a dying breed, that they're not going to survive. Do you buy that idea?
You know, as somebody who's studied media history, I think it's interesting that if you look that newspaper number of newspapers has declined since World War I, circulation has been flat for a number of years. If you go to the 1920s and you look at the magazine articles, they predict the end of newspapers because of radio. And you look at what radio became. So I decided, well, would this hold true in the 50s? So I went to the magazine articles in the 50s, and it talked about how television would replace certain things, including, I think it's funny, for academics. In the 1920s, they said, well, radio will replace college education because you could, at that time, order a syllabus and have it sent to you and then listen maybe every Wednesday night to class.
That's what they used to – that's why they called it educational radio before right. Public radio.
Oddly enough, the audience didn't hold to that. And there's a wonderful story in a New York magazine where the family, the mother, wants everybody to listen and learn from this class and this great professor. And about 5 minutes into it, the kids are pleading to turn it to music. And they did. I think the same thing held true for television. Television does teach. It does inspire, as we've seen with Murrow. But it did not kill newspapers. And if you look at the rise and fall of American mass media, what we're really looking at is the decline of this massive audience held in place for unusual reasons. And one of the reasons was the barrier. You and I could not start a newspaper. Legally, we could. But we could not afford to print anything. Now the printing costs have dropped completely. I think that's a good thing. We look at television. What prevents the two of us from having a television station is the federal government license. And we would say, well, doesn't that violate the First Amendment? I mean, shouldn't we all have access? And there are reasons for that. But having limits, to me, it's like damming up a river. And the age of mass media was this period where entry was hard, costs were high, and very few people did it. But it wasn't that they lost their interest. If you go back to the 1700s and the 1800s, when you had multiple papers in town and papers starting up and papers dying and papers of different views, there was always that excitement and that energy. I think many people have always wanted to express themselves in many forms. The form just became harder. So if we look now at newspapers, it doesn't necessarily worry me too much that newspaper circulation declines from the time when it was a monopoly in town, where there was limited ability to compete. It's just interesting to see how it will shake out. I think if we look at almost 90 years of the reduction of newspapers, radio did not replace newspapers. It replaced maybe a component, or it replaced time. The real issue is, how much time do people devote to an area? And I think the early studies were showing that with the internet increase over time, it was taking away from television. Now, readership is still dropping, and readership has dropped considerably. I go to a place like Japan where the newspapers, the biggest newspaper there, would equal the top 10 newspapers in America. American newspapers are essentially local papers. So their size has not always been that big. We also know that newspapers, people pass them around, and now people read them on the internet. So I think the journalism side is still strong. Whether it will be on a press, printing a certain number of copies, a certain amount of time, and having a certain profit margin, it cannot hold to that. I mean, there's no way. If you introduce 50 competitors into any world, then you cannot hold your percentage. It just can't happen. The same drop has occurred in television, certainly. And I'm often surprised when people say, well, newspapers are dying because of readership. Well, the Final Four for basketball, even though everybody says they're big basketball fans, look at the ratings for the Final Four. The percentage of people watching the Final Four has dropped over the years. People watching the Super Bowl, the percentage has dropped over the years. All of these things have dropped over the years. The shows that were canceled in the 1970s draw far more than the top 10 shows today, almost, on television. And it's a competition issue.
And some people might say that is one of the problems, because we used to have larger audiences, so we were engaging in a democratic conversation that involved a large part of the population. And now with niche publications, we're losing that. Do you see that as a problem?
It's the most fascinating part of this is it's not as much about journalism or about newspapers as it is about democracy. What is the effect on democracy? Television changed the political process, especially at the presidential level. It changed campaigning. It changed, for many people, religion. The ability to sit at home and watch religious programming on Saturday, Sunday, Monday, whatever. It changed sports. The access that it gave people. When the percentage, the shared, I guess, that shared culture, that television culture, the fact that we used to be able to know that third graders all watched the same show, and when they arrived in college, you sort of knew their cultural history. That lack of sharing makes you wonder what holds us together, and it's a democratic issue. I mean, it really is. When you say about democracy, how do we get messages out, important messages out, and will it be easier to turn off those messages that we don't want to hear, that we don't want to know about? Will the ignorance rate go up? Will we simply, in our selective exposure, selective retention, will we limit ourselves? And I think in a way it's sort of what people say about going to a library. They talk about going to a library and walking through the shelves and just discovering things. There's a moment of discovery. And with newspapers, there are moments of discovery, things that you would never have found before. There are people who say you're still going to do that on the internet. If I look on a blog and it has a link and I'll hit that link because something jarred me to go in that direction, then maybe that sort of thing will happen, and maybe it will happen just as easily. We don't know. I think that's the fascinating part for the next 10 or 15 years. We looked at an area called agenda melding, and the idea was, what happens when people sort of join a group, and by joining that group, they join that group's media. In other words, people can join a group now, have their own DVDs, have their own newsletters, have their own cassettes, have everything. They're living in their own media world with the view of that group. It is in some ways worrisome, but I guess in a way choosing between limited access or, from a First Amendment perspective, everybody has access, then I still have to think that democracy will be better served. We just have to see if it happens.
Because I think many people would argue that blogs, in fact, are promoting democratic conversation to address that issue.
Absolutely. And the one thing that anyone who's ever worked at a newspaper recognizes is that it was essentially a one-way communication. I mean, at least newspapers run letters to the editor, but those are often from people who take the time to sit down. There are many people who respond to your story immediately, have no way or feel like they have no way of presenting that back to you. Today they do, and they do it. I think probably the only concern is, can it be hijacked? Can you round up 1,000 people to push back in a certain area just simply because this is your view or your campaign or your issue? I guess we have to rely on the intelligence of people. And if we look in the markets in the 1800s when there were 8 newspapers in a city, it seemed to work. It might have been a little uglier, but elections still happened. Progress was made. And you're right, the feedback potential is tremendous. And if you look at any communication model, what separates mass media from any general communication was size of the audience, really the number of receivers, but also the limited feedback. I mean, a conversation, you have immediate feedback, but mass media feedback is quite limited. People say, well, you turn off the TV and that's feedback. Well, sure, but that's not a dialogue.
Is there a problem here? We train people in journalism education to be journalists, and yet many of the people who are writing blogs, who are providing information on the internet, are not journalists and therefore don't have the same kind of training in issues of objectivity and truthfulness.
It makes you wonder what the future of objectivity is. Objectivity is essentially a 20th century model for newspapers. For television, it was imposed because of limited access. And so we created laws to say you must be fair, you must do these things. That does not hold true in a marketplace with multiple outlets. It does not. And we often find that no matter who the people are, they're attracted to people who think like they think or think about the issues they think about. It's just natural for you to seek out these people. And that's why you remembered the names in the past. I would argue that one reason people don't know journalists today, print journalists, is because they are objective. And so essentially the byline shouldn't matter. So people dismiss those bylines, but they seek out certain people. So when you look and see where the fairness doctrine was dropped in the 80s and the rise of talk radio, AM radio at that time, of just the issue-based, generally a certain side, tremendous response, audience response. People loved it. If you look at blogs, they particular points of view attract particular people. Being neutral, being objective, does not often draw a crowd. We would argue as journalists that there's a role for that, that there clearly is, and we still teach it. But the point of a blog is not necessarily objectivity. In fact, it's usually not. It would be rare to have people. That's not to say they aren't truthful. That's not to say they don't point out many things. It's not a criticism of blogs to say it's a completely different style. They accept that. They know that. That's what makes it work. It is a big question, though, is objectivity going to survive as a model for journalism over the next 50 years? It developed in the 20s with corporate ownership in some ways. It developed with the Associated Press sending out the same story to 100 different outlets. It developed for a number of reasons that were not tied necessarily to the audience. it was tied to advertisers wanted this, or it's a cheaper model to send one reporter to write for 100 papers of different views. But it wasn't something that the audience stood up and demanded, I don't think, at any time.
It's curious, I think, that Ernie Pyle was not, for most of his career, an objective reporter.
If you look at, I used to always say when I would teach media history, we're going to study all the reporters who were not objective. Because if you look at Ida Tarbell, if you look at the Crusaders, if you look at Nellie Bly, if you look at these people, I mean, Pulitzer, if something happened in his town, it was on the front page and he would almost run you out of town. I mean, there was no point where he said, on the other hand, a spokesperson said, you know, he just would not tolerate that. People love that journalism. They bought it. We talk about yellow journalism, and I want to separate that from really this journalism of trying to accomplish goals or being an activist, that in some ways, I think poor people argue, or outsiders argue, objectivity always supports the status quo. We're going to balance these two issues. On the one hand, you say you're starving and you don't have any heat and you don't have this and you don't have that. On the other hand, you know, you come in with this balance. Scientists often say this, that if there's something that scientists truly believe in, if journalism needs to go out and find the other side, what is the other side? I mean, do we say the earth is round? But on the other hand, you know, somebody argues. So you create this. I wondered sometimes if you have 99 people in a room, we believe that even in falsehoods, I mean, if we think back to that original idea that there is some truth in all, and that if we let truth and falsehood fight it out, it will get stronger and we'll have more truth. Do we then balance those two? Do we balance the, do 10,000 people who believe one thing and one person on the street who believes something else? Is that balance? So objectivity is a tough discussion for journalism schools in the future. We believe in it, yet at the same time, we recognize that I think it's, without exaggerating, is under assault from all sides.
Let's take another break and hear some more music that you like.
I got married in December, and my wife, Hiromi Sumiyoshi, has a band, Southern All-Stars, that she loves. And this selection I chose from that. We've been together a good while, and we've traveled to Japan and traveled through Asia. And when I lived in Japan, I was fascinated by the fact that I could listen to a lot of songs. My language skills are limited. I wish they were much better. But the students would bring me songs. I mean, even if I didn't understand the words, they would bring me songs. So they would give me all of these songs. And I fell into a pattern of loving the music, loving the songs, and not understanding a word. And I think in this case, this song has obviously some Japanese, some English, but it's a song that's special to her, and I think would mean a lot to me too because of that.
Welcome back to Profiles. We're visiting with Brad Hamm, the dean of the School of Journalism at Indiana. Brad, what was the name of that song?
The song, she translates for me as Sweet Eri, or My Sweet Eri. And the band is quite popular, has been around for a couple of decades. And is when I travel there, I can see the presence of the signs, the and in the music stores. When I was in Osaka and I taught there, I would go, the students would want you to go to different places with them, and they would want you to go to concerts, and they would want you to go to music stores. And I was surprised, I think, there and in China, how much music means culturally. I mean, we understand that at a basic level, but people, more than anything, wanted to share food, and they wanted to share their music. A little bit, they wanted to share our movies, but they wanted to share their music and their food, and I love that.
Now, I mentioned at the outset, you're nearing the end of your second year as dean of the School of Journalism at Indiana. Some people would ask, why would anybody want to be a journalism administrator now when the state of journalism is in such flux? So I'll put that question to you.
I think a lot of people wonder why anyone would be an administrator. People often say if you get fired as a dean, you get the job you really wanted, which is to be a professor, to teach, to do research, to read, to study, to talk with people, to travel to other countries, to work with other journalists. And so you have the ultimate life, and then you choose to abandon it for administration. The reason I'm an administrator is I like building programs, and I like building, I like projects. And I also think that one of the things that excited me about the University Elon, where I was for many years, is that they had an interesting approach to education. And if you said, we're going to teach an international journalism class, they might say, well, where are you taking them and what will you do? And it was beyond the classroom. And so you learned to think beyond. Yes, you wanted great things for them to read. And yes, you wanted lectures. It wasn't abandoning those, but what did you add to it? What was it that they would never forget, that experience? And so I always think in terms of from 18 to 22 for the undergraduate population, how do you change their lives from the time you get them until the time they leave? What is it that they will never forget? What is it that, and I think study abroad is one of those. I think my time abroad made all the difference in the world. If you're an administrator, you have the ability to connect maybe the money to the class, to the idea. And that's what excites me. That's what, when I come here, it's for all of that. It's not for all of the issues that you deal with day to day. I try every day to think of something that's exciting. What is it that will keep me going? And what is it that I can focus on that we move ahead? Because you're always going to be overwhelmed with issues. Many issues you didn't know about, you didn't create. They're important at the time. People are important. People always have good things. People always have issues. It could be health. It could be something at that moment that you're constantly dealing with. And it all comes to that point. That part of it is what you accept with the job. But I think in looking at what we're trying to do of making the journalism school one of the best in the nation, of giving 18, 19, 20-year-olds these possibilities to take an Ernie Pyle class to Europe and to sort of follow in his footsteps, to dream these things and to dream them for the 19 and 20-year-olds, to dream them for the graduate students, to imagine what research might be there. All of that's exciting, and that's why you do it. And so as an administrator, you're in a position to make it happen. And that's why you do it. And if you lose that ability to make it happen, or if the place doesn't allow you, then there's no need to be an administrator, and just unless you just are there for the power. And I'm not interested in the power. I don't think power resides in academic administration. It's for the excitement of being able to build things, to do them. That's what really interests me. And I'll do that as long as it lasts. But I'm just as excited about teaching abroad, and I'm just as excited about research, and those are things I've postponed for now because I'm more excited at the moment about making a difference here.
You're effectively only the fifth administrator since the Department of Journalism was formed in 1910 or 1911. There's some disagreement on which it was. Joe Piercy and John Stemple and Dick Gray and Trevor Brown. What do you see that's valuable in the tradition of Indiana journalism?
This may be the only place with 100 years of history with four or five leaders. I've never seen anything like it. I'm not sure that I would outside of journalism, inside of journalism. I've never seen anything like it. And those people clearly had their eras. I mean, that if you talk to people, I just returned from a trip to the West Coast where I had the great fortune of talking with Dick Gray's widow and talking about that time. I met John Stemple's son, who's in L.A., and we talked about that time and why it mattered. And I hear people, I saw Chris Savage's widow yesterday, and I told her, there's nowhere I go in America where people don't say from that time period that her husband made a difference. So when you look at that, and I think that's the great thing about being a professor, and often they don't hear it, but I do when I talk with alums. I hear about the people who changed their lives, and they remember them so fondly. That I don't know as much about Piercy, but I do know that Stemple mattered in people's lives. And there are people who today, no matter where I am, who want to tell me these stories about him. And then I hear about Dick Gray and what he did. And Trevor Brown, the fourth dean or director, obviously I know Trevor and I had lunch with him. They had these time periods and they had these problems that they faced at the time. I always think Trevor had to even figure out the role of computers. I'm not sure that journalism is as hard to understand. We don't know where the profession is going, but we believe fundamentally that the education is still about, it's about the history, it's about law, it's about ethics, it's about understanding concepts, it's about applying intelligence to writing about issues that you don't know necessarily as well as the people you're interviewing. It's about the ability to write. It's about the ability to speak. It's about the ability to tell a story visually. And so our curriculum is fairly basic in that sense. It at its heart, it believes in those core courses connected with the ability to write. And I think regardless of what you do in your life, I met a Catholic priest in California who's working with immigrants there, journalism degree. I meet lawyers all the time with journalism degrees. I meet people all over the country with journalism degrees, and they return to those basic ideas. If you understood history, if you understood law in the broader sense, if you worked very hard, if people told you every word matters, and they worked very hard on your writing, and at the end of that, you came out of that as somebody with the ability to think, to write, to do it on deadline. I mean, just these enormous pressures, and to have 200,000 people read it and tell you exactly what they thought about it. If you can do that, you can do a lot of things in this world.
Who should be teaching in journalism schools? Some people would say journalism is a vocational school. On the other hand, a journalism school is part of a university that expects considerable amount of research and public service.
And this year in university more than others. I mean, I think at some schools it would be obvious to make it more of a professional program. We serve those two missions, I guess. We have a research mission, a very clear research mission. We must hire those kinds of people and must do that kind of work. That's important. It's important for the profession, too. And I think of a book that we had just recently called The American Journalist. That book matters to the profession. It's an important study. It's a serious study, and it matters to day-to-day journalists. A professor I worked with on the idea about a rise and fall of American mass media 20 years ago predicted many of the things that we're talking about today. And I remember one day getting a call from the New York Times, one of the leaders of the New York Times, saying, "We've run out of copies here. Can you send one? We're having a board discussion." Those ideas matter, and journalism schools can contribute to that as much as anyone. We can help in the training in the community. We can do a lot of things. But we also know that many of our students come to us seeking some role. And it is a job, but it's a job. Journalism is in some ways bigger than making money. So we have to train people that way. And I sort of lean toward a model of, if you go the professional route and you're going to hire professionals, hire those people who clearly are or have been determined to be remarkable. Who are the Pulitzer Prize winners in our field? Who are the leading journalists in our field? I think that's the future for us at Indiana University, is this balance between who are the top scholars. Many of those scholars, and at my previous place, we had a rule where all of those scholars must have journalism experience to understand it. Today, it's evolving so quickly that there are places for people who don't have the traditional journalism experience. But for the most part, we're looking at a combination, and I think that will serve us well.
Let's take another break here and hear some more of your music.
I spent a semester in London, and one day I was walking from class, and I was headed down the street, and it hit me how much I loved London. And I always thought I loved Kobe at the time, and it was my favorite city. And I wasn't sure that I wanted to go to London, and I wanted to teach there, but I never knew that I would fall in love with London the way that I did. And I lived in St. John's Wood, for people who know that area, and the canal is nearby, and Little Venice and all of that. But right around the corner is Abbey Road. And I, whenever people visited, they always wanted to go to Abbey Road. So I would make this walk to Abbey Road constantly. And without fail, Owen, there were 30 people crossing the road exactly like the Beatles, which was for them somewhat of a lark. I mean, if you listen to the history of that time, that was not intended to be the cover shot necessarily, or they claim it wasn't. They were going to travel great distances at great expense. And then they decided they just didn't want to do it, so they went out and they took that picture. Across that road all day, all night, people do that. And then they write on the wall, and they're from countries all over the world. And so the Abbey Road reminds me somewhat of the Beatles, and I love their music, but more about the time in London and what that means and living there.
Here comes the sun, here comes the sun, I say, it's all right.
That was Here Comes the Sun from Abbey Road. And I imagine a lot of people out there can picture the album cover as they were listening to it. Brad, it's been good to have you on Profiles. One final question, and I'm going to ask you to be a little bit brief. It's a school of journalism, but these days there are a lot of people from public relations and advertising and other kinds of non-journalism fields. Is that a problem for the future of journalism?
We're still training journalists, and the idea is, can a building do multiple things? We believe, I think, at our heart that if we train advertisers and we train PR people, that we train them to write, to do these things. And I think we have to train in ethics. So the question that people often ask is more about, do you train people to mislead the press in the building where you train the press? And my response is no, that's not what we're training. And that model exists throughout most of the country where we're combined. Many of our great PR people were journalists. They switched from there for different reasons. And in our building, the same thing is true. There are a lot of great journalists doing a lot of great PR. And so the conflicts would come on the ethics side. And that's not what we're encouraging. We're encouraging people with ethics to do the right thing, particularly in nonprofit PR, which is an exploding area.
I suppose in a way it's all about communication. That brings us to the end of this interview. Brad, thanks for sharing your thoughts with the WFIU audience.
Thanks, Owen.
Our guest today on Profiles was Brad Hamm, the Dean of the Indiana University School of Journalism. I'm Owen Johnson. Thanks for listening.
The program you just heard was recorded in March of 2007. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily McCord was our research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.